From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. It's tradition on the show to mark the new year with a look back at our favorite segments of the last 12 months. All of us at Good Food make a list, as one does, in the new year, and then we compare notes to see where our top picks overlap. This year, there was one segment that was on every single one of our lists: my interview with Michelle Zauner. Not only did Michelle write a best-selling memoir this year called Crying in H Mart, but she was nominated for 2 Grammys as the front woman and visionary behind her band Japanese Breakfast. In short, she is a literal rock star. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Michelle. I asked her to start by reading the first paragraph of Crying in H Mart.
Ever since my mom died, I cry in H Mart. H Mart is a supermarket chain that specializes in Asian food. The H stands for Hanarim, a Korean phrase that roughly translates to one arm full of groceries. H Mart is where parachute kids flock to find the brand of instant noodles that reminds them of home. It's where Korean families buy rice cakes to make tteokguk, the beef and rice cake soup that brings in the new year. It's the only place where you can find a giant vat of peeled garlic, because it's the only place that truly understands how much garlic you'll need for the kind of food your people eat. H Mart is freedom from the single aisle ethnic section in regular grocery stores. They don't prop goya beans next to bottles of sriracha here. Instead, you'll likely find me crying by the banchan refrigerators, remembering the taste of my mom's soy sauce eggs and cold radish soup, or in the freezer section, holding a stack of dumpling skins, thinking of all the hours that mom and I spent at the kitchen table, folding minced pork and chives into the thin dough, sobbing near the dry goods, asking myself, am I even Korean anymore if there's no one left to call and ask which brand of seaweed we used to buy?
I've read that page so many times, and it still just brings me to tears. Your mother was working at the front desk of a hotel when she met your father, an American who found himself in Seoul selling used cars to the U.S. military. They moved back to the States not long after you were born. What was your childhood like growing up biracial in Eugene, Oregon?
I think as a child, it was something that I felt was something that made me really special. You know, it was before the sort of differences that you possess away from your peers begins to feel like a pockmark, which I feel like is something that begins to happen more in the teenage years. But even growing up in Eugene, where, you know, the population is maybe 95% Caucasian, as a young child, I really enjoyed my biracial upbringing, and I was incredibly privileged to get to visit Seoul every other summer. So it really felt like I possessed the best of both worlds for a time.
What was the response to you when you would go back to Korea on your biannual trips to visit family?
It's interesting because I always just felt extremely coddled. You know, I grew up in a really small family. It was just my mom and my dad growing up in Eugene. And when I went to Seoul to visit my mother's family, I was surrounded by relatives. My grandmother's apartment was a 3-bedroom apartment with my 2 aunts, and my cousin lived in this little closet side room, and my grandmother's there. And my mother and I would sleep on a cot on a futon on the ground in the living room. At that age, you know, I was so used to like growing up alone without siblings in the woods. And it was kind of a lonely childhood. And going to Seoul and being sort of coddled by all these Korean women was a real delight for me as a child.
Could you describe the role that food had in these visits and some of the experiences cooking or being fed that remain like indelibly etched in you?
Yeah. When I was a kid, you know, I was such a tomboy, and I really struggled to be good. My mom was constantly scolding me because I was very reckless and rowdy and impatient. And, at an early age, I began to realize that while I sort of couldn't be well-behaved or good, I was excellent at being courageous. And I was always really rewarded for being a courageous eater. particularly in Korea, I remember all of my relatives would always sort of call me yeppo, which meant pretty, every time I ate well. So it was always something that was really celebrated in my home. I think I also just didn't realize, you know, I think my mom was really withholding about her homesickness. You know, she was sort of shielding me from that, maybe part of her that she kept hidden from both my father and I. And every time we visited Korea, you know, she just really lit up to eat the sort of foods that she'd been missing. And that was a really big part of my childhood that she really wanted to share with me. I think in a way, watching me really enjoy the foods that she grew up with really made her think, you know, that one's mine.
How old were you when your mother was diagnosed with cancer?
I was 25 years old when we found out that my mom had a stage 4 GI cancer.
And where were you in your life at that point?
I was sort of floundering in all of the ways that my mother had warned me I was going to flounder. You know, by then I had lived away from home for 7 years, and I guess she had kind of accepted that, you know, playing music was not something I was going to grow out of. At one point, she said something really lovely to me where she said, "I just never met someone like you before. I realized I just never met someone like you before." And I had kind of taken that to mean like, you know, I get it. This is not something that's going away, and I didn't get it before, and now I'm going to give you the space to go and do that. But, you know, things weren't going particularly well. I was in a band, a severely underrated band called Little Big League, and I was living in Philadelphia, and, you know, we were doing a lot of sort of DIY tours, sleeping on floors, paying our dues, playing basement shows to, you know, 10 people, getting paid in cigarette butts and cans of soup. And I got the call when I was in New York. I think I was beginning to kind of question, like, if this was really going to, this lifestyle was really going to work out for me, because I hit 25, and it was sort of like, well, maybe if I haven't made it so far, I should start coming up with a backup plan. And I was in New York, I think basically trying to start getting that backup plan together. I was hanging out with a friend who worked at a music magazine called The Fader, thinking maybe I could get involved in music journalism when I got the call that my mom was sick.
And at that point, the women in her life took shifts caring for her. Food must have been a very fraught and important part of that caring. How did food find its way to how you tended to your mom, and then later on reconnecting with memories of her?
I think a big reason why I, beyond, you know, the general idea of food being this love language for a lot of parents and their children or families, I think that there was also this sort of sense of shame that I was trying to undo, that I had failed as a caretaker. I really struggled. You know, there was the first like 6 weeks that my mom went through her first chemo treatment, and I had flown to Eugene to live there as a caretaker. And I knew, especially as an only child, that I had this sort of responsibility, this sort of major role reversal was coming. And that, you know, I had always feared this moment, and it had arrived much sooner than I had thought. But I really wanted to take that responsibility of caring for my mother and nourishing my mother. And I discovered, you know, this part of me that you know, was always this like unquestioned part of my identity. I am Korean. I know this. I know Korean food. Suddenly I realized I didn't know it as well as I thought. What I love about Korean food is that it really presents the extremes. You know, our seafood is like freshly killed and still moving often. And the hot food is, you know, scalding and still bubbling in these little earthenware cauldrons. And cold food is served in bowls of ice or like on the rocks, you know. It's really red. It's really spicy. It's really flavorful. And, you know, when you're going through chemotherapy and you're nauseous all the time and you're developing sores on your tongue, you can't eat that kind of food. And I was really at a loss of like, what can I make my mother? I don't know the type of dishes that you eat as a Korean person when you're ill, because, you know, why would I have eaten those things growing up? So I really struggled. And a lot of, you know, there's a section of the book where I sort of list a number of failures, you know, not for lack of trying, to try to find how to feed my mom. And it was just extremely difficult. There was this woman that came to live with us named Kay, who really took that over. And I think that after my mother passed away, a lot of the reason why I started cooking Korean food maybe was this sort of psychological undoing of like this shame of failure that I felt during the caretaking process of not knowing how to help her.
You found your way to Mangchi.
I did, yes.
Many people have. Myself included.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
So Mangchi is a really famous YouTube Korean cooking teacher who has now written several books. What was it about her that you found solace and help in?
Well, I think that one thing about Korean culture is that, it can be very private. I think a lot of East Asian cultures don't use this measurements or write down recipes. It's this, you know, maybe sort of private thing that's passed down within families. And so when this woman came to live with us, the sort of education that I was sort of mysterious and barred from me. I asked her a number of times, please let me help you prepare these dishes. And you know, it wasn't really something that was readily shared with me. And I think that a lot of Korean families have this kind of coveted information. So Mangchi was one of the few people I found that taught you how to cook Korean food in English and sort of readily shared this information that seemed, you know, very private from other women. And she's such an like effervescent presence. She's completely magnetic and so such a soothing woman. And I remember she pronounced zucchini and my mom, I had such a wonderful memory of the way that my mom said zucchini. I just had such a comfort from her, and I started sort of following her videos religiously, and discovered it was the one real joy, week to week, was like getting to cook with her. And she came to mean so much to me. This YouTube vlogger I'd never met really saved me in a lot of ways, really brought joy back into my life in a very quiet way.
Thank you so much, Michelle.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Michelle Zahner, also known as Japanese Breakfast. Her beautiful memoir is Crying in H Mart. Coming up, while I don't necessarily condone weight loss resolutions, I am aware that many use the new year to start a new workout routine. So when we return, we will revisit another favorite segment of 2021, the joy of sweat. That's next.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. You're listening to our favorite segments from 2021. You've heard the sayings, don't sweat the small stuff, didn't even break a sweat, blood, sweat, and tears, and of course, having the meat sweats. The spectrum of perspiration from effort to excess is wide. Culturally, we identify sweating as shameful, but is it like that everywhere? With the $75 billion a year global deodorant and antiperspiration industry, Sarah Everts gets up close and personal in her book, The Joy of Sweat. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
So a whole book on sweat is just so, so up our alley. We were thrilled when we got the book.
I'm glad.
So physiologically, how and why do we sweat?
So sweating is our evolutionary superpower. It's actually one of the things that distinguishes us from a lot of other animals because it helps us cool down and cool down extremely efficiently. So when your body starts getting a little too hot, your sweat glands get the directive to open up and to dispatch sweat to the surface where it evaporates. And that process whisks the heat off the surface of your skin and out into the atmosphere.
Why is sweat salty like tears?
It's because of where sweat comes from. So the sweat that comes out when we're overheated is sourced from the watery parts of blood. So effectively, as you have blood gushing through your circulatory system, right, you get this temperature directive to cool the heck down. And so your vasculature, your veins, pop up against your skin. And by the way, that's why people who are light-skinned turn a bit red, because you can actually see their blood pushed up against the skin. And those veins up against the skin have two sort of goals. One is to provide a source for the sweat glands to have a fluid to use. And so, you know, red blood cells, platelets, and immune cells are filtered out. But that watery stuff that's in blood, that base, is actually what ends up as sweat. And then the other reason is because, of course, the whole cooling process is cooling blood as it's rushing by. So it's bringing hot blood from your core up to the surface and then returning it back. And the reason our sweat is salty is just because our blood is salty. In fact, you know, we're salty oceans inside. We need salt for all sorts of biochemical processes. And so the salt is kind of incidental. It comes along for the ride. We don't actually need to do anything but evaporate water. And so the salt and everything else that comes out in sweat is left behind.
Why can sweat sometimes smell like the foods we eat?
Well, it's because pretty much anything that you eat gets absorbed by your intestine and gets dispatched to your blood, right? So, you know, if you eat a lot of garlicky foods, some of that, you know, that odor is circulating around in your blood. And so when it hits your sweat glands, it also percolates out. And, you know, what's interesting about that is, you know, just about anything that's in your blood comes out in sweat. So evidence of a beer that you had or a morning coffee. So I had my sweat analyzed by a forensic chemist who could tell just in a fingerprint, which is, by the way, just a sweat print. It's inked in sweat. That's what fingerprints are. She could tell just by the trace amount of chemicals left behind in a fingerprint that I had had a morning coffee. You know, researchers are actually trying to learn about people who are at a crime scene from the chemistry of their fingerprints. Because, you know, typically forensic scientists look at, you know, the way the whorls and the swirls, how a fingerprint looks, and they compare how it looks to a database. But what if you don't get a hit in that database? You don't know anything about that person that has left the fingerprint. Well, that's changing. So she, for example, working with some English police, lifted a fingerprint off a windowsill. It was from a stalker. And she analyzed just the single fingerprint and found that he had been drinking alcohol and taking cocaine at the same time. So all sorts of stuff is coming out in your sweat and, you know, getting left behind in fingerprints and, you know, on the sweaty drips you leave on your yoga mat.
So one of the most fascinating parts of the book for me was your encounters with sensory analysts. Talk to us about when you had your armpit sniffed.
I'd love to. It's so funny. I was terribly excited to have my armpit sniffed because I thought, oh my gosh, I can't believe this is a job. And then I got there and I'm like, oh my gosh, somebody's going to be sniffing my arm kits. What have I signed up for? But yes, there are people in this world who get paid to be what's called a professional nose. And, you know, sometimes they're sniffing, you know, a company's new coffee brew or, you know, set of whiskeys. And sometimes they're working for deodorant companies to assess whether, you know, a new formulation, you know, keeps odor away for 24 to 48 hours or something like that, right? And because we have two armpits, you know, this is perfect for science. You know, science always wants a control. So you put the product in one armpit and in the other one you leave free. And the whole process is kind of absurd and surreal. So the first thing you do is you like lift your arm up and put your hand behind your head to kind of like reveal your armpit to the sniffer. And then she or he or they will lean in and get to about 6 inches away, at which point they'll do a sequence of bunny sniffs. So tiny little sniffs so that they don't overpower their nose, their sensitive organ, if your BO is like super strong. And by the way, yeah, bunny sniffs is the technical term. And, you know, then they'll take a breath, a breather, and then they'll sniff your other armpit. And I found it like very nerve-wracking because not only was somebody doing something that, you know, I've spent money to avoid, right? I wear deodorants and antiperspirants. But this was a professional nose, somebody who had like expert sensory organ devoted to sniffing. So yeah, it was a double whammy.
I understand that there is a phenomenon of people who have perspiration that is a color.
Yes, chrome hydrosis.
How does that happen? Why does it happen?
Yeah. So chrome hydrosis is caused by all sorts of things. In the book, I write about a woman who shows up at a dermatology office because her sweat has turned red. And not only is it alarming because that's a very abnormal thing to happen to your body, but she's also a nurse and, you know, wears a white uniform and worries about, you know, her professional reputation because, you know, her uniform needs to stay white. And, you know, when she sweats, literally, you know, her collar and her armpits are turning a reddish pink. And the dermatologists are both fascinated and totally stumped because she's super healthy. She's in her 20s and they cannot figure out what is going on after they do a battery of tests until she comes in for a follow-up appointment. And she shows up with, you know, kind of a red stained finger, a little bit similar to people who roll their own cigarettes. And the doctors know that she is not a smoker. And so they're like, what on earth is on your finger? And she's like, oh, it's my favorite snack. And it was like this spicy tomato corn chip that she had something of a fetish for. She was eating 45 bags of chips a week. And effectively, the scientists showed that the red flavoring and coloring that was on the chips, she was eating so much of it, it ended up coming out of her pores and her sweat. And that was, again, because, you know, she's eating it. And you know, the chemicals in those corn chips are being pulled out of her intestine and into her bloodstream, you know, whipping around her circulatory system and then coming out in her sweat. And so that's one kind of chrome hydrosis, but you know, it can be caused by all sorts of things. So the dye in cranberry juice turned one guy's sweat red because he had a lot of bladder infections and was trying to cure it. But there are other people whose sweat turns turquoise, and that's copper workers who have trace amounts of copper, you know, that land on their skin. And then the salt in their sweat corrodes the copper, creating a color that if you've ever seen, you know, a copper-plated building, it can turn this like glorious turquoise color, which is, you know, beautiful in an architectural setting, a little bit alarming on your own skin.
So fascinating. Thank you so much, Sarah.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
That was science journalist Sarah Everts. She teaches at Carleton University and has a master's in chemistry. Her book is The Joy of Sweat. From the joy of sweat, we go to the joy of smoke. In his 2021 book, Black Smoke, food scholar Adrian Miller writes, "Black-run barbecue joints often find themselves located at the intersection of food, race, and absurdity."
Barbecue was one of the places where people kind of ignored the color line in terms of restaurants. So you would often find whites going into the black neighborhood to get barbecue.
Adrian joined us last summer to share the surprising and often overlooked beginnings of American barbecue. Hi, Adrian.
Hey, good to be with you.
Let's start at the beginning with the word, which has its roots in West Africa. Can you explain how barbecue's history starts with the indigenous people of the Americas and then the primary cooking techniques that were used?
Yeah, and the reason I start with the indigenous people in the Americas, mainly mainland North America, is the Caribbean origin story never really quite gelled for me when it came to Southern barbecue. Because that story is that Europeans show up in the Caribbean, they see indigenous people cooking in a way they're not familiar with, and then Europeans bring that to the North American mainland. And, you know, the way that Southern barbecue emerges is just so different from the way that at least what the Europeans observed in the Caribbean was. So I argue that really it was a fusion of Native American kind of smoking techniques. And there were multiple ways that Native Americans were cooking. So in some senses, they were having sticks that were aimed towards the fire, and there would be morsels of meat kind of angled toward the fire for cooking. There was spit cooking, which Europeans would have been familiar with. There was also something called an earth oven. So it was really like a vertical hole with a fuel source in the bottom and then layers of meat and vegetation. And then you bury it and then come back at some time later and eat that. There was also kind of the raised platform, which is what people saw in the Caribbean. And then also a very shallow pit, which a lot of times the meat was just laid right on the burning coals. And so what I argue is that Europeans saw some of this and then added their own grilling techniques. And that put us on the road to barbecue. And then later, when enslaved Africans increase in number, they become barbecue's principal cooks and add their own kind of culinary signature to what would become barbecue.
So talk a little more about that transition.
What surprised me in researching this book is that Native Americans were the first barbecue cooks, really, and that they were enslaved as well. So the earliest forms of barbecue were probably cooked by enslaved Native Americans and white indentured servants before the transition to African slavery. So then when enslaved Africans are asked to cook this way, they start to meld their own kind of meat cooking and smoking traditions from West Africa with European grilling techniques and what Native Americans were doing. And it becomes this kind of unique thing. So a lot of people in the time of colonial America called barbecue cooking the Indian way. And what you find is there's some African-American barbecuers well into the 20th century who still described this kind of old school barbecue as cooking the Indian way. And that was digging a trench a few feet wide, a few feet deep, filling it with hardwood coals that were burned down, and then taking whole animal carcasses. So that could be a pig, sheep. If they did a cow, they would usually quarter it because cows are so big. Butterflying them, sticking poles in the side of them, and then somebody flipped those carcasses regularly to cook them without burning and then added sauce throughout the process. And so that was what barbecue was originally in terms of like Southern barbecue.
How did it figure into antebellum social life?
So in the early years, especially in Virginia, I agree with some scholars that Virginia is really the birthplace of Southern barbecue. Early on, it was really small gatherings, usually wealthy people getting together. And then the other side of barbecue was kind of rowdy parties where usually dudes got together, shotguns, gambled, played games, told lies, all that kind of stuff. And then over time, as barbecue becomes more popular, politicians and preachers get a hold of it and supersize it. So by the time we get to the 1820s and 30s, we're seeing reports of barbecues with 10, 20, 50,000 people. And I think barbecue was perfect for these events because it was so scalable. As long as you had enough labor, and usually that's why they turned to enslaved people because they could make them do this work. As long as you had enough labor, enough animals, and enough space, you could pull off a barbecue.
One of the most powerful parts of your book are just the numerous profiles of these legendary figures of Black barbecue that everyone should know. Could you just tell us some stories about some of these people?
Yeah, you know, that was one of the most fun parts of researching this book. So a couple people who come to mind. One is a woman named Marie Jean. That would have been her French name. She was also known as Mary John. But she was a woman in Arkansas Post, which was one of the earliest European settlements in what we now call Arkansas. And in the 1840s, there are newspaper reports of this enslaved African-American woman being what we would call a pitmaster. Back then, they called it superintending. And so they talked about her being in charge of these big barbecues. So, I mean, just think of that. Enslaved Black woman, in charge of barbecue, telling dudes what to do. Eventually, she buys her freedom and runs a restaurant in Arkansas Post. And when she dies in the 1850s, the local newspaper eulogized her and really celebrated her cooking. So I just think that's a remarkable story. And it shows you that at least in African-American circles, women were in the barbecue game going way back.
So fascinating. Could you share another profile with us?
Yeah. So another woman who was very interesting was a woman named Ernestine Vandeval. And she was from Nicodemus, Kansas. And if people don't know about Nicodemus, they should spend some time getting to know about it. It's one of the oldest all-Black communities in the U.S. And it was started by a group of people called Exodusters. And these were people who left the South for better opportunities right after slavery ended, so right after emancipation. And she grows up in this community and she moves to California and she ends up running a barbecue and soul food joint in Pasadena, which was beloved. Evidently, Walt Disney loved her food. And she ends up later in life returning to Nicodemus and opens a barbecue restaurant there, which still exists to this day. And her niece runs it now because Miss Vandeval died several years ago. So her niece, Angela Bates, runs this place. So every summer, usually last weekend in July or first weekend in August, Nicodemus has what it calls homecoming days. And so any living descendant or, you know, person who used to live in Nicodemus, they come back to this community and it's a big party and anybody is welcome. And Angela Bates opens up the restaurant and serves up some very tasty ribs.
Wow. Who is out there that you want us to know about?
One guy is Matt Horn. He's in Oakland. And you know, he's on the way to opening up the brick and mortar spot. It's kind of hard to do that these days. There's another guy, and I'm sorry, I don't remember his name, but I remember the restaurant is called Veg Mob because vegan barbecue is pretty hot trend right now. And so I want folks to know about them. Also, if you haven't seen Queer Eye, the Jones sisters in Kansas City, Kansas, great people doing great food. Their sauce business has taken off after being on that show. And then the coolest thing about them, or one of the cool things, but I just love this. They have a barbecue vending machine. So 24/7, you can just show up and get sandwiches or whatever. I just think that's brilliant.
Well, Adrian, what a pleasure. And I just look forward to so many sessions with this book, reading all the stories.
Well, thank you so much.
Adrian Miller is a certified Kansas City Barbecue Society judge and a recipient of a James Beard Foundation Book Award for Soul Food, The Surprising Story of an American Cuisine, One Plate at a Time. We've been discussing barbecue and his latest work, Black Smoke. In a minute, when Comfort TV gets uncomfortable, one of our favorite segments of last year was about the cringier moments of the Great British Bake Off. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. In April of 21, we asked author, professor, and friend of the show, Karen Tongson, to host a special episode of Good Food to address a wide swath of issues that have been percolating in the AAPI community. Karen is the department chair and a professor at USC's Department of Gender and Sexuality Studies. She teaches a class called Food Culture and Food Politics, which I've visited several times as a guest. And her range as a thinker and moderator is truly impressive. In this next segment, she talks to her colleague at USC, Professor of American Studies and Anthropology, Doreen K. Kondo, about a show that they simultaneously love and sometimes cringe at, The Great British Bake Off.
Now, first of all, I want to talk a little bit about our mutual relationships to The Great British Bake Off, which is perhaps one of the most comforting TV shows, or universally lauded as a comforting TV show. And I'm a big fan of the show, and I watch it to ease my mind and listen to the tinkle piano. How about you? What's your relationship to GBBO?
Well, I too am a fan. It's become part of what I also call comfort television, or what some other folks have called ambient television. And particularly during this time of the pandemic and, you know, and the uptick in racialized violence and so on and so forth, there's something innocuous and soothing about it. Somebody even proposed to me facetiously that Great British Baking Show should serve as a model for the presidential elections, because there's something very cooperative and low-key amongst the contestants. So I, you know, have been using it really as just almost ambient TV. Like, sometimes I just keep it on, like, most of the day, you know what I mean, as background noise. I've seen every episode, like, easily five times, I would say. So I'm a huge fan. And there are also, you know, other things about it. I mean, I think those of us in the U.S. and the other colonies may have what one analyst called colonization of consciousness in a way, but there's something deeply familiar and soothing about the peaceful, stately vision of the pastoral with the manor home and the beautiful verdant lawns and the ducklings, you know, swimming in the pond. And there's also, I think, an important element for me, because to me, the UK is exotic in a certain sense. So they have quirky comedians who express their exotic British humor to me, and a vision of multicultural Great Britain that we will see is not completely a truthful depiction.
Well, so let's get into that.
Yes.
So, yes, it's alluring. It's comforting. There are soft, fuzzy goslings who make us feel warm and fuzzy inside. And then we have these theme weeks. And in particular, during this last season, there was something called Japan Week.
So Japan Week began with a kind of emphasis on what Judge Paul Hollywood, who had been to Japan fairly recently, apparently, you know, called kawaii, the cute aesthetic, you know, Hello Kitty and so on and so forth. And UK Twitter noted that it sounded a lot like kawaii. It was mispronounced, of course, which means scary. And the scary elements of, you know, racism raising its ugly head happened all too often there. So one was certainly the illusion of all of Asia. So Japan became any Asian country. There were contestants making, you know, using Chinese flavors, Thai, you know, whatever it was, certainly not Japanese in any way. One of the motifs on a kawaii cake was a geisha on the one hand, and then pandas, for example, which are, you know, associated with China, right? So it was just a mishmash. It's the culinary equivalent of we all look alike.
So something that was supposed to be explicitly Japan Week became this kind of jumble of pan-Asian assumptions, which I don't know. You watch the show. I watch the show. I don't see this happening with, say, French Week.
No. Oh, my God. You know, because that's the thing. It's like there's such deep knowledge of, you know, the intricacies of this or that genre of French baking or British baking or Italian, you know, any European style practically. So Asia becomes this kind of general, like, huge world area, so you can more or less bring in anything. So that, once again, is an index of what the post-colonial theorist Gayatri Spivak called zones of sanctioned ignorance. What are you allowed not to know? That becomes part of how a certain kind of power, racial power in this instance, gets perpetuated. It's not that one is overtly discriminatory necessarily. It's just that there's this vast ignorance. It's not accorded the same respect and nuance as you would, say, French cuisine.
Speaking of this, you know, the kind of vastness of assumptions that get ascribed to Asia as a region, one of my most hated terms on food television that, you know, we see in practically every reality competition show is this phrase, Asian flavors.
Absolutely.
And the idea of harnessing said flavors either for success. I know this comes up in a lot of shows like Top Chef, especially if it's a non-Asian chef using Asian flavors. There seems to be a kind of mysticism ascribed to Absolutely. What they can accomplish or do versus the idea of the Asian flavors as sometimes unrecognizable or off-putting, as it were.
Absolutely.
I know that in this particular episode of The Great British Bake Off, there were a lot of scrunched up faces vis-a-vis matcha and yuzu and other ingredients like that. Tell us a little bit about what happened in the show and what you think about this term Asian flavors and how it's worked in the kind of food competition world.
I was particularly struck on The Great British Bake Off in earlier seasons, but also this season, by the inability to appreciate the depth and subtlety of certain kinds of quote-unquote Asian flavors, in this case, Japanese flavors. For example, matcha, which is originally a tea ceremony tea, so very refined and expensive, and you would only have a tiny little scoopful, and there are all these elaborate whisks and so on and so forth in traditional tea ceremony, but now it's become widely marketed. But in season five, the contestant Rav, who had traveled in Japan extensively, brought in matcha and yuzu, a kind of fruit that is neither lemon nor lime. So Judge Paul Hollywood came down on Rav extremely hard. It's like, my mind is trying to decide whether this is lemon or lime, you know, and he was so discombobulated that, you know, he made his comments like very harsh and unpleasant. I mean, he told Rob, watch your flavors. It's like if Hollywood had been a little less provincial, you know, I think Rob would have been evaluated more highly.
Well, it's like yuzu becomes the quote unquote inscrutable oriental.
Absolutely.
It's the inscrutable oriental flavor to Paul Hollywood, who's like, is it lime? Is it lemon?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, and then matcha becomes also, you know, Mary Berry, the grand dame of British baking, just found matcha grassy.
Which brings me to another, you know, kind of implicit bias question vis-a-vis cooking competition shows and food shows like GBBO. And that's the very concept of meritocracy.
Absolutely.
And the justifications for who stays or who goes resemble how we evaluate performance through the lens of race in other contexts.
Yes, I think it is very much so. And I think it's undergirded by factors that come into play in all settings. Ruha Benjamin, a professor of African-American studies at Princeton, calls whiteness as second chances. So, you know, you'll give someone the benefit of the doubt. In this last season, for example, there was a kind of debonair, posh, opera-going, refined, ambitious baker, Rowan, who had great ideas, but he just never finished any of them. And then there was Florence, another white contestant, very pleasant, but she came last in the technical competition. She just seemed like a messy baker, frankly. And this was episode two. There was a South Asian contestant, Makbul, who was very, at that point, solidly in the middle. He had come third in the technical. So that was very good for a second episode. But somehow, because he didn't knock the socks off one of the judges, he was thrown out, basically, or eliminated. In the first episode, it was equally bad because Larea, who had immigrated from Jamaica, I mean, it was just using stereotypes of Black women as excessive. So her flavors were too much. They were too spicy, quote unquote, too loud in a certain way. I mean, it was just, I was just horrified for the first two shows. I mean, it just, I watched, but with such a sense of dread and fear. It's like watching a horror show instead of watching a baking show.
Well, so I did want to emphasize, I know that we've been raining all over The Great British Bake Off, and it's a beloved show, and we both love it. But I did want to talk about, I wanted to ask you about this. How is it possible to still derive joy from a show like The British Bake Off while recognizing its flaws and problems, you know? So, you know, what I want to underscore is the conversation we've been having kind of diving into these issues is not about canceling things or media that fail at AAPI representation, but I think it's about expecting more out of what we love and enjoy. So could you tell us a little bit about how we can continue to still derive joy from a show like this, even while acknowledging its flaws?
Well, I think it's, what can I say? I mean, I think that minoritized people along whatever axis are, that's how we operate. We have to, because there's so little that actually speaks directly to us in a way that we can kind of unambivalently enjoy. So this process of bracketing, like, oh, I don't like that part, but yes, I love this part, is kind of always in place. And it's the kind of extra energy and extra effort, I want to write about this actually, that it takes to find comfort, to find the joy. So there, you know, it is possible. I'm cute. I still love the Great British Baking Show. I keep it on a lot, but I just try not to play those episodes that I know are especially problematic. I just hope that people who are not in a minoritarian position will recognize this kind of extra effort. A friend of mine said, oh, it's like you always have to be braced at every minute. And that's right, I think, even in the comfort of your own home. That said, I think that there are still, you know, possibilities to push these shows that exist. But I think the real answer may be, let's create our own and let's find places where we can find solidarity and joy and connect with others.
Thanks so much, Doreen, for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Katie.
That was Karen Tongson in conversation with Doreen K. Kondo. Karen is the department chair and a professor at USC's Department of Gender and Sexuality Studies. And Doreen is a cultural anthropologist and professor of American Studies and Anthropology at USC. Up next, one recipe, 8 different chocolate chip cookies. That's next when Good Food continues. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Way before the sun is up and most of Los Angeles has opened its eyes, Roxana Julepot flips on the lights and turns on the ovens of Friends and Family, the restaurant and bakery she owns with her husband in East Hollywood. By the time the doors open at 8 a.m., the pastry case glows with baked goods, alive with the colors and textures of whole grains. A longtime advocate of the modern grain movement, Roxana compiled recipes, some of which you'll recognize behind that glass, into a cookbook that many of us have been waiting for a long time. It's called Mother Grains. Hi, Roxana.
Hi, Evan.
Well, this book was worth the wait. You have such a clear, strong voice.
Oh, thank you.
You were an early advocate of the local grain movement. Did you have an aha moment that really plugged you into it?
I feel like probably the most clear revelation for me was gaining an understanding that grains are also seasonal. And as you know, because we've known each other for a long time, we, my husband and I, and like the school of cooks from which I stem from, it's a firm believer in seasonality. You know, we're in California. We cannot escape it. It's all around us. So it was just a matter of connecting that missing dot.
I know that you took some time to travel around and visit farms, and you went up to the Washington Bread Lab, which is sort of a famed place of pilgrimage for bakers who want to use grains from their local food sheds. Can you share what those experiences were like for you to push you in this direction?
It's interesting, the approach to grains that we have here in America versus the approach to grains that other cultures and other countries have to grain. Here, we it's kind of like something we discovered, you know, or rediscovered. Like it just occurred to us that maybe we should reconsider this whole like commodity flour model and study all this ancient grains and like ancient varieties and bring them to modern times and help them acclimate to new microclimates and an ever-changing world. and how to best utilize them in a modern context, right? But then the most interesting travel I did was right before we opened Friends and Family. I had the opportunity to go back home to Costa Rica, where I had grown up. And then also I spent some time in Turkey. I went to Bhutan. Eventually, I ended up in Scandinavia. But what I was really enriching to me was to sort of like not look at grains as something to be rescued or something that was necessarily new, but something that is already part of us and the fabric of who we are. And we just have to reconnect with it. So as you know, growing up as a Latin American kid, I was thoroughly exposed to corn. And I always had access to vocabulary that explained to me that there were more grains than just this wheat that we use for everything, that is highly refined and grown in, at a very industrial scale. So it was really, really cool for me to see the ease in, with which other people, other cultures, other countries, other cooks, other bakers just treated grain without kind of like sort of like having to write a treaty about it.
So in your recipes in the book, do you use any white flour, any what we would think of as all-purpose flour?
Indeed, I do. And let me just start by saying that I dream of a day when we can all bake with 100% whole grain flours. However, I think of refined flours as a tool and use them as such. But for flavor and texture, the whole grain flour has to be central. So the only reason why white flour in minimal amounts is in the book is to sort of like fill in wherever the whole grain flour might come short. Depending on the grain, it can be things like lack of gluten, a greedy texture. Sometimes you can have a bitter flavor of a starchy aftertaste. So that's the role of the refined all-purpose flour or even refined bread flour. It just comes in as a building block while the whole grain flour is there to be the assertive and identifying note of the baked good.
7 of the 8 mother grains can be used in your chocolate chip cookie recipe. Can you sort of riff on the properties that each of the flours impart to the cookie and then what your preference is?
So I think I was thinking as I was writing the cookbook, I knew I was going to have to do this. I was going to have to tell people, because people were going to ask me, right? And they do, and they still do, and they do it all the time. How can you substitute one flour for another? And how do you know which flour is appropriate for which use, right? And I always have this saying that, you know, you can use whichever flour you want, wherever you want, as long as you know what the flour is capable of, right? Because if you know that, for example, buckwheat has no wheat, you'll know that you'll have to like match it up with a flour that is glutinous, right? But that is like really easy for me to say and really easy for me to understand because I bake. I bake every day. So I knew I was going to have to do a recipe in which you could use all of these flours or a great variety of flours and that they were going to yield results that were very similar, or that you would have a delicious result no matter what the flour was. So let's start with barley. So barley is a very special flour. It's very, very low in gluten. And to me, like, I mean, categorically, it represents fall, fall flavors, spice, warm notes, 100%. So the cookie that it produces is a little butterscotch, not a little, quite a bit butterscotchy, very, very brown sugary. It also has a really nice texture because that's what barley flour is. It's a very tender flour. I really, really like the buckwheat chocolate chip cookie. There's definitely an incredible affinity between the darker grains, such as rye and buckwheat, and chocolate. So I find this cookie to be a little bit sober, a little bit more adult, and absolutely delicious. It's also terrific with just like a black cup of coffee. The oatmeal chocolate chip cookie is super playful. it will taste a little bit lighter, but it has it also have like that chew that oats will impart in a recipe. It makes a terrific ice cream sandwich. The rice chocolate chip cookie is a very interesting cookie because rice is very neutral. So the way it reacts when we put it in a recipe is that it adds a little bit of sweetness, but it's not sugar. It's a sweetness with a little bit more depth, but it also adds tremendous crunch to a recipe. So I like to bake them just until they're crispy on the outside, but it's still a little bit softer in the center. And that crispy edge with rice flour is like buttery magic, crunchy deliciousness in your mouth. The rye chocolate chip cookie, like I said, great affinity between rye and chocolate. It is the one version, the version that we make here at the bakery. And it is all of those things, like very elegant. And it also, like the rye flour tends to have a little tartness to it. So it balances the sweetness of the chocolate. And it's terrific with just a few flakes of sea salt on top. Then the Sonora wheat chocolate chip cookie is really great. Sonora, you know, a really awesome flour that we produce tons of here in California and the West Coast. Very sustainable, super climate friendly. So this is a winter cookie. Like nobody will object to this cookie. Nobody will have like, interesting choice of flour kind of thought. You know, this is this will hit that spot, like that whole house fantasy you have in your head of a chocolate chip cookie. And it's also very kids friendly. So for those of us who bake for children often, this is an excellent way to introduce them to whole grains and talk about flour and flour that grows close to them. And of course, spelt chocolate chip cookie works great. Spelt is a great flour because it's pretty user-friendly. You could almost utilize it as an all-purpose flour, one-to-one.
I cannot tell you how much fun this conversation has been. Thank you so much, Roxana, for just the way you talk about food. I mean, you use the words sober and playful to describe cookies. It's just the best.
Thank you so much. It's always such a pleasure to talk to you, Evan.
That's Roxana Julepat, friend, baker, and author of the new book, Mother Grains, Recipes for the Grain Revolution. Pick up a copy next time you visit her at Friends and Family in East Hollywood, and check out her chocolate chip cookie recipe on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. If you missed any of today's show, don't fret. Just listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. You can also subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, Desmond Taylor, and special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, Gary Masiha, Kenny Ng, and Nick Lamponi. I'm Evan Kleiman. Happy New Year, everyone. We can only hope, right? I'll be back next week with a brand new edition of Good Food.